Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When they take the Hippocratic Oath, doctors swear to treat all patients equally. But a new report released by the Institute of Medicine says that patients are not being treated equally, that color is a factor, and that a race gap between minority and white health care is very real. The report is a wake-up call to doctors and an already beleaguered medical industry. Across the board, the study found minorities get lower quality health care than whites, even when their income and health insurance plans are exactly the same. Minorities are less likely to get proper medications for heart disease. They're less likely to undergo complex or expensive surgeries. They're less likely to receive the most sophisticated medicine. The result? Higher minority death rates from cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and HIV/AIDS. Listeners, are you getting the best health care possible? Or at least as good as your white neighbors? Have you felt race play a part in your health care? And doctors and nurses, do you believe these new numbers? Do you understand what produces them? Is there bias in the doctor's office? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Joseph Bettencourt. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee that prepared the report on racial disparities in healthcare. He's also a senior scientist at the Institute for Health Policy and director for multicultural education at Massachusetts General Hospital. Good evening and welcome, Joseph Bettencourt.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
And with us from Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Dr. Bettencourt, what is it all about? What is the size of this gap in quality of health care between races? And you make it real to us. Give us some examples of what the study found.
Well, Tom, our study found that there is evidence, overwhelming evidence, in fact, of unequal treatment of patients based on their race and ethnicity once they're in the healthcare system.
How unequal? How big a scale? Are we talking tiny margins of difference or something really substantial?
I think we're talking about some substantial differences, but it's a very complex issue. I think it's important to understand that Congress, in giving us the Institute of Medicine a charge to look at these issues, told us to look at disparities within the healthcare system. Clearly, there are a variety of factors outside the healthcare system, such as issues related to social determinants, housing, education, employment, issues that contribute to disparities in health, and those have been well known and acknowledged for quite a while.
But those are disparities in health, and you're looking at disparities in health care.
Absolutely. And what we found in our examination of hundreds of articles, public testimony, expert panel opinions, commission papers, and focus groups, are that there are significant disparities. They're unrelated to insurance and many times unrelated to socioeconomic status. They cross multiple conditions, including cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, end-stage renal disease, pain management, HIV, and in fact, they do contribute to an increase in mortality for African Americans and other minority groups.
Joseph Bettencourt, make this real to us. Give us some examples of how a white patient and a black, brown, or other patient might have different treatment.
Well, you know, we looked at factors within the healthcare system, and so that allowed us to look at systemic factors and also factors within the medical encounter, and that was part of our charge. And we found that the causes are, in fact, multifactorial. If we look at healthcare systems, systems that are complicated, where there's an incentive placed on productivity, decreasing the amount of time a physician could spend with a patient.
Which means almost every HMO.
That's correct. Lack of interpreters when there's language barriers, focuses on cost control, clearly affects all patients. But what we found is that it affects communities of color disproportionately, perhaps because of different health beliefs, mistrust of the healthcare system. It's an interrelated issue. And I think that so systems clearly contribute to disparities. When we look at factors within the medical encounter, these factors having to communicate with patients in a short amount of time, having to communicate with patients when we're multitasking or under stressful situations, in fact, can contribute to stereotyping, which is a process of using ideas about certain groups and applying them to an individual and thinking that perhaps certain individuals may not want to adhere to a certain therapy, may not be interested in invasive treatment. It's a complicated issue.
So are you saying then that there's a kind of racial quick connect between white doctors and nurses and white patients that makes it more likely that a white patient will get the best treatment in a time-pressured, economically pressured healthcare system?
I think that in a time-pressured system, people that are able to communicate more effectively with the physician have a closer cultural affinity, in fact, may, in various different ways, have better health outcomes. And in cases where, in fact, there is a racial difference or a cultural difference, our evidence shows that there are disparities. And I think part of our challenge now is to even dig deeper and figure out what the
costs are. Please put some meat on the bones of the statistics you're giving us. Give us some examples of circumstances in which care might be different, real-world examples.
Sure. Cardiovascular disease, I think that's where the literature is richest. Patient comes in, there's literature support that African-Americans who present with chest pain are managed differently. Perhaps their symptoms are not seen as serious. African-American patients who come in who, in fact, have received a cardiac catheterization and have a blocked artery are not referred for angioplasty or are not referred to bypass surgery with as much frequency as whites. And this is controlling for comorbid factors or other conditions that might contribute to decision-making, controlling for severity of disease, controlling for socioeconomic status. So clearly that contributes to higher cardiovascular mortality.
When you say controlling for A, B, C, and D, what you're telling us is that in your view, this boils down to somehow a race bias. That everything else is controlled out of the picture and it leaves you seeing this as directly tied to race.
I think that if we look at the evidence clearly suggests that there is a race component to this. Bias is a tricky word because bias in some ways implies intent and discrimination is also a word which implies that this is being done intentionally. And I think the committee found that although we cannot rule out discrimination, clearly there was no direct evidence of racism on the part of physicians. So I want to put that out there right now. But I think that clearly...
Wait, let's stop right there. Racism can be active or passive. It can be conscious or sub or unconscious. You're saying that none of those apply here?
Not at all. No, what I'm saying is that, as you mentioned, these are conscious and unconscious factors, and they're very difficult to measure. In fact, we've seen them measured very well, racial profiling in criminal justice. We've seen racial profiling in housing. We've been unable to identify that type of behavior specifically.
And yet
health.
You've controlled for all other factors but race. And in the case of angioplasty and heart bypass surgery, you're saying African-Americans in New York, for example, are 37% less likely to undergo those treatments. And you're saying this isn't racism of one stripe or another? What is it then?
Well, I can't say that it's not racism. I could only speak to the evidence of the report. And I think that it would be wrong for me to say that I have 10 studies that show direct racism. I can say that there's a significant amount of literature which highlights clinical decision-making, stereotyping as methods of bias. I think it's up to debate. I don't think we've studied it well enough to say that there is or there isn't racism. I could just only speak to the findings of the report thus far.
Black Americans are 3.5 times as likely as whites to have their lower limbs amputated as a result of diabetes. Why?
Well, clearly, this speaks to the complications that patients have had in the years and years of perhaps not being diagnosed with diabetes or going untreated or being treated without the highest standard of care. And this results in complications, severe peripheral vascular disease, which requires amputation. I think this is more an indication of patients not getting adequate treatment over the long haul.
Black Americans are 63% more likely of being untreated for pain relative to whites. Why?
Very interesting. Two studies done by the same author, Dr. Knox Todd, looking at patients who presented to the emergency room with long bone fractures. African Americans and Hispanics both given less analgesics for their pain.
Why?
We think there may be some components of communication that the doctors not understand the way the patients are expressing their pain. Could the physicians think that certain patients may be seeking narcotic analgesics or certain pain medications more than others? That's where the stereotyping plays into it. Are there certain things about our society, clearly, that spill over into healthcare? We acknowledge that. And could they be applied into the medical system? that's a very significant possibility.
Jack Beatty, here's a new fascinating window on the American healthcare system with some pretty startling numbers at the top of the list here.
Yeah, and this stereotyping is interesting. In the report, they mention a study in Los Angeles that showed that Latino patients received less pain medication because of the myth of the stereotype that Latinos can endure more pain. Now, that's a frightening example of this. It's shocking to realize that black life expectancy is now shortening for the first time in the 20th century, and that something like 50,000 blacks a year, their deaths are excess deaths. That is, they wouldn't have occurred if the death rate was the same as that of whites. Something is badly, badly wrong here, And I'm sure it involves resources, but it probably also involves just the sorts of unconscious assumptions. For example, the doctor mentioned one. Is this patient asking for pain medication because he wants to take drugs or because he's in pain?
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of clutch that a doctor might go through that could prevent that patient from getting pain relief.
We're making some interesting distinctions here tonight. Our guest is Dr. Joseph Bettencourt. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee that prepared this new report on racial disparities in healthcare. He's careful to draw a line between the general state of health of any given population and the health care that individuals and groups as racial groups receive once they come into the health care system. You know, in a way, Joseph Bettencourt, aren't these results obvious or predictable? I mean, medicine doesn't exist separately from society. You're a doctor. Why are doctors surprised that social inequities, stereotypes, maybe racism, get translated into the medical system?
You know, it really is a tough pill to swallow for physicians. I think that we go into this profession with the highest values and the desire to achieve the best health outcome for every patient we see. So I think it's difficult. And, yeah, I think a lot of this is obvious in broader health, but I think that within the healthcare system, this has been something that, quite frankly, the healthcare system has not wanted to acknowledge. And we've wanted to feel like medicine is colorblind, that we treat each patient the same, no matter what their race, ethnicity, culture, class, or language proficiency is. And I think this report sheds light on the fact that that may not be so.
What's the reception that this report is getting within the medical community? Are they saying, no way, we treat people fairly, straight up, everybody's the same to us, and you're making up a bogeyman here?
Well, I would say two things to that. Initially, when our committee convened, we had a variety of people on the committee who weren't expert or had no experience in this area. And on first blush, when we were presented with this challenge of understanding these problems, many, in fact, said that. Not me. You know, I treat all my patients the same. And in fact, as the committee gathered its evidence, we made some serious steps, and there was a lot of converts saying, boy, this really is a problem. Thus far, up until today, the reaction has been very, very positive. If you look at edit op-eds, we've had about 15 op-eds around the country. There's a couple of letters to the editor today in the New York Times that supported our study. And in fact, the American College of Physicians today, in an earlier discussion I had with them, have come out in full support. They understand this is a complex problem, and they really are stepping to the fore and want to solve it. And they've developed a variety of different programs, so I clearly respect them very much for that.
Mm-hmm. You say blacks are 20% less likely to receive follow-up care after being discharged from a mental health facility. Minorities are less likely to receive breast cancer screening, eye examinations for patients with diabetes, beta blocker medication after a heart attack. What margins are we talking about here? Some of these numbers are 30-40% higher. Are others slimmer margins of distinction?
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned those. That's a very recent study done just about 2 weeks ago, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association by researchers here, Eric Schneider and Arnie Epstein and others, that looked at disparities in managed care, which in Medicare managed care, which was in fact a real step in a new direction. We haven't documented disparities within managed care that effectively because managed care has not collected race and ethnicity.
But what is, if you can generalize, what's the average size of the gap? We're not talking generally about whites getting care twice as good. We're talking about margins of 30%, 20%, 10% difference in,
sure,
in quality care of offering of particular treatments.
I think when you add them all up, if you look at cardiovascular disease, diabetes, for example, cardiovascular disease, biggest killer in this country, cancer, diabetes. Let's just take those three conditions. This has significant impact on health outcomes. So margins may be smaller in one areas and larger in others, but on the whole, this is a serious problem, and this is a problem we need to address.
We're talking tonight with Dr. Joseph Bettencourt. He's a senior scientist at the Institute for Health Policy and director of the Multicultural Education Program at the Massachusetts General Hospital. And the issue is a race gap that his group's study has found in healthcare. Are you surprised to hear that there's a gap in healthcare? Have you felt yourself shortchanged at the doctor's office on the basis of race? And doctors or nurses, give it to us straight. Have you seen, are you aware of race bias in health treatment? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a race gap in American healthcare with Dr. Joseph Bettencourt. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee that's prepared a recent report saying, hey, there's a gap, and it is real. Have you felt yourself being shortchanged at the doctor's office on the basis of race? Doctors and nurses, give it to us straight. Have you seen, are you aware of race bias in health treatment? Have you, as a medical professional, felt yourself withholding care from a patient of color? Are American doctors impatient with, less sympathetic toward patients who don't look like them, eat like them, speak like them? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Michael is on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm actually a registered nurse, and I do work at Mass General, and I work in an ICU.
Mm-hmm. Intensive care unit.
Yes, I do. And I treat all my patients equally, no matter what their color or their ethnicity is. I'm there for the patient. I'm a patient advocate. I'm not there for Mass General or for any other hospital. My priority is the patient, and whether they're, you know, using IV drugs or whatever the scenario is, you know, if they're telling me they're in pain, then, you know, they deserve the right to be medicated properly. And I always assess my patients for pain continuously.
When they need it. Michael, God bless you. But then here are these numbers. You know this, these situations up close and personally. Perhaps you never do deliver treatment with any bias around race, Michael, but how do you think these numbers emerge? How do you think this gap occurs?
I think maybe part of it is maybe lack of education.
On the part of whom?
On part of the patient. And I think maybe part of the problem also may be in the fact that, you know, when you have someone who has a cardiac cast, you know, and then the physician doesn't prescribe them to follow up on it, you know, to further treat the patient, I think that's almost to the extent that they're neglecting the patient.
Mm-hmm. Michael, thanks so much for your call. Joe Bettencourt, what about it? Michael says, I don't discriminate, but yet he's willing to acknowledge the numbers are there. He says maybe it's a lack of education on the part of the patient. This suggests that a minority patient, I guess, might suggest that the minority patient is less likely to know what treatment to ask for? Or is this a kind of bias in itself?
I would say, first of all, that there are many committed healthcare providers of all types that would agree with Michael's assessment and behave like Michael. So I think that that should be put out there first. I think that clearly that is what we all aspire to, and I'm sure he does do a wonderful job there. I think if you look at the data, though, we have plenty of studies where education is controlled for, where clinical decision-making is looked at in a vacuum, and socioeconomic status, job, education are all the same. So I would just encourage people to take a look at the evidence. All I would say, I think in healthcare we rely our work, our life on evidence. And in fact, the evidence highlights the issue that education in many cases and many studies was controlled for, and there were still differences.
So you're saying it's not as easy as assuming that maybe the patients don't have the education, know what to ask for. You're saying even when educational levels are equal between races, there's a distinction. Jack Beattie, I heard you there.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, I just wanted to ask the doctor, you've controlled for education, for insurance, and for income, but of course you couldn't control for history. And I'm wondering, is there, with these chronic diseases, a Tuskegee effect? That is to say, did you find any sort of sort of systemic distrust of, quote, white medicine on the part of African Americans, stemming quite understandably from their history and especially from the Tuskegee syphilis study, in which nearly 400 black men were not told they had syphilis and were allowed to suffer for this disease for 40 years. Did you find anything like that that would make patients either delay seeking care or, once they had care, not to follow through to the letter of the instructions?
Joe Betancourt?
Well, I would say that we had, as one part of our evidence stream, focus groups, and we had resounding evidence from the focus groups. In fact, and focus groups are not quantitative, they're just anecdotal, but clearly gave us a resounding sense of the fact that patients are mistrustful of the healthcare system. This is further corroborated by a couple of surveys, one done a few years ago by the Kaiser Family Foundation, that asked patients whether they were mistrustful about the healthcare system, and clearly found that African Americans and Hispanics other minority groups were mistrustful for a variety of different reasons, Tuskegee perhaps being one of them. And there was some recent work done now by the Commonwealth Fund that, again, corroborated this finding and showed that patients are mistrustful. Mm.
I want to bring into our conversation Dr. Karen Scott Collins. She's vice president of the Commonwealth Fund. It's a private foundation that supports independent research on health and social issues. Good evening and welcome, Karen Scott Collins.
Hi, good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. You have looked at just really what Jack is touching on here, at patient attitudes about the quality of their care. What have you found among minorities?
That's right. And Dr. Betancourt was just picking up on some of our recent findings from a national survey of minority patient experiences with care. And some of the striking areas for us also revolved around communication problems between patients and physicians, where minority patients across the board, African American, Hispanic, and Asian Americans, were all significantly more likely to report problems in communicating with their physician. And these included not feeling as if the doctor did not listen to them, to their concerns, not fully understanding what the doctor said to them, and leaving the doctor's office with questions that they had but had not felt comfortable asking.
Karen Scott Collins, do you take from that? Do communication problems then absolve the system or sort of doubly condemn it?
No, I think that it's a clear signal to an area that needs to be addressed. And in fact, I think it needs to be addressed, for everyone in order to improve quality of care. Mm-hmm. But the onus really is on the physicians and other healthcare professionals to identify ways to improve communication skills, particularly when there are when it's across different racial and ethnic groups or across language barriers, because we're not going to be effective in delivering the health care that we know can be so effective if we don't find ways of addressing these barriers.
We're talking about a race gap in American health care. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Dr. Karen Scott Collins, what apart from communication problems, what other major complaints did you hear from minority patients in their perception of the quality of care that they got in the U.S. healthcare system?
Yes, we were also struck with findings that minority Americans were more likely to say that they felt they had been treated with disrespect during a recent healthcare visit. They were also more likely to feel that they would have gotten better health care if they had been of a different race or ethnicity. And we know from other work and as well as anecdotally that, if you have a bad experience, as one of the commentators was saying a few minutes ago, if you have a bad experience, you're just as likely not to go back to that doctor, not bother following up. And that's part of what probably contributes to what winds up being long-term complications of chronic diseases.
So if patients don't really have faith in their doctors, maybe you're suggesting they won't necessarily comply with the doctor's advice. That sounds like something that will have long-term implications. And maybe does that suggest that the problem is not all on the physician's side here, or does the medical profession just have to step up, sort of take the blame, if that's what you want to call it, and make it better?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot that can be done, both on the side of physicians as well as finding ways to strengthen a patient's ability to be involved in making decisions about their health care and, and understanding what they need to do between visits and to help take care of their own health. But the doctor's office really should be the focal point. The doctor's office should be where they're able to get that kind of information and that kind of support. So we're the ones who are trained to do this. Mm-hmm. I think we do have to step up and take those first steps.
Michael is on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm an African-American, well-educated. Mm-hmm. I have a master's. I'm a teacher as well. Mm-hmm. I have great access to health care through my health plan at my school. But I must say I'm very distrustful of the health care. I feel very wary of going to doctors. Whenever I go to doctors, I often feel that they're too quick to medicate, not eager enough to listen to me. I feel as if a recent experience I had, the doctor was a new doctor. He hadn't read my file beforehand, so he comes into the room, he's looking at my file, and as he's looking at me, he's like, oh, and I just felt as if, what is this guy doing? Why hasn't he read my file? Why isn't he prepared to talk to me?
Okay, Michael, let me interject just for a moment. You're African-American, and you're feeling all this. I've got to say, I know a lot of white Americans who go into the HMO arena and feel a lot of what you're feeling as well, but take it further for us. Do you feel there's a racial element to it?
I feel it's racial. I think part of it is, and again, I'm well-educated, and I'm not always mm-hmm. looking for the boogeyman, and I'm not always looking to blame the white man for my problems.
Mm-hmm.
But, the Tuskegee, as already mentioned, I think as I've been listening to the conversation, as I've been on hold, I feel as if I'm not sure I'm going to add anything new to the conversation. But
you're adding already.
The Tuskegee piece is something mm-hmm. that's always in the back of my mind. I remember that. I know that happened, and I think, is this person out there for me? Does this person care about me? And when I mentioned first being too quick to medicate and not eager to listen to me, to allow me to listen to my body, every time I go to a doctor, it seems that they're quick to say, you have this, you have that. And the person barely knows me. And a few years ago, I was diagnosed with lupus, and I said, well, you got to be kidding me.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back just a couple months ago, and he says, well, I guess you don't have any more. I said, well, what happened? Where'd it go? What's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not a sense of caring about me. And you're right. Probably there are whites who feel the same way. But when you're black, part of the problem of living in a racist society is that when things happen to you as an mm-hmm. African-American, this is the way I feel, the
you gotta wonder.
Becomes part of it. I mean, when I get pulled over, mm-hmm. I'm probably speeding or I'm probably doing something wrong. But because I'm living in a racist society, my first instinct is this something to do with race or is this something to do with my doing something wrong?
Michael, hang on. Karen Scott Collins, mm-hmm. is what we're hearing here from Michael typical of the kind of suspicion that African-Americans take into the doctor's office? Is there an extra burden there that white patients don't take in?
Yes, Michael said it so well in terms of and very much reflected the kinds of findings from our survey. Part of what Michael's describing, I think, does reflect some problems with quality of care across the board in terms of mm-hmm. very time-pressured visits and no one feeling like the doctor really has time to listen to you and no one feeling like there isn't a bond as they should be.
I end up feeling sorry for the doctor half the time. They seem so harried. But then I don't have to sit there thinking maybe there's a racial bias here.
But as Michael said, when what we see in our survey, over 6,000 people, is when it's an African American patient or a Hispanic or an Asian American patient, there's this added layer of you have to wonder of would the doctor be this rushed? Would the doctor be this quick? If I weren't minority.
Michael, thanks so much for your call. Ellie's on the line. Welcome, Ellie. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Thanks you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I come from a Hispanic background
mm-hmm.
and have been exposed to the American healthcare system for a number of years, and I work in marketing for a company in the medical area.
Mm-hmm.
And having that experience and having that cultural background, I think one of the issues has to do with we have a lot of biases in our culture about what we demand or not demand from differing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that goes away against politics.
Are you suggesting, Ellie, that Latinos might be less demanding in their interactions with the...
Absolutely. And you just think that because of respect, you would not be asking so many questions of your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of respect. It's a matter of Okay,
that's interesting.
You either trust them or not, and
right.
if you really respect them, you don't want to offend them by asking questions and be perceived as the one that you don't know what
right.
you're talking about.
Ellie, that is fascinating. Hang on, let me put it to Dr. Joseph Betancourt. You hear Ellie's bringing up a very interesting point. I spent a lot of time in Japan where Japanese never ask the doctor anything. It's considered really bad form. Could it be that white Americans are simply more assertive in their interaction with the medical system, that some racial minorities may not ask for as much, and so they don't get it?
You know, I think that this is that type of behavior is not the domain of any one culture group. There are certain cultural norms, in fact, but
okay.
you highlight mm-hmm. cross-cultural issues, right? So your mm-hmm. experience in Japan and the Hispanic culture, perhaps. I think the key here is that physicians and the healthcare system, and I in no way mean to put this all in the lap of physicians. Clearly, I'm a practicing physician. I am that harried person. And I think that for this whole issue, there's no one solution or suspect, and there needs to be discourse. But clearly, the onus is on me when I have a patient in front of me to determine their style of communication and, in fact, use certain tools and skills to empower them to ask me questions and to
mm-hmm.
let them feel comfortable asking me questions about their condition, about their treatment. So I in different ways, communicate in different use different mechanisms for communication based on the patient's communication
mm-hmm.
style. So whereas I agree that is a major factor, it's probably a cross-cultural issue. There may be – and I've seen white patients who are very respectful and haven't wanted to, quote-unquote, cross any lines. But clearly I work hard to make them feel comfortable and get them empowered and feel like they could ask questions. So I think there are things we can do.
Minorities account for, I think, only about 9% of all doctors, and that includes African-American, Asian-American, Hispanic, Native American. Ellie, let me ask you, do you think that a white-dominated medical establishment is capable of hearing across the cultural gaps?
I think they are if they're trained properly. And personally, I have my doctors at Mass General, and I'm very pleased with the service I've gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, speaking in behalf of my doctors, I think they're very tolerant, and I agree they can have tools that can help them work through the issues and make their patients feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be nice if we had a more diverse group of medical professionals to deal with,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think it's a hindrance if they're well-trained.
Ellie, thanks so much for your call. Dr. Karen Scott-Collins, if bias can't be ruled out as a source of the difference in health care, where's this bias coming from?
Yeah, I think the Institute of Medicine report handled that very well in exploring some of the mechanisms and causes behind it, the stereotyping, which Dr. Betancourt was discussing earlier, the kind of history you get used to putting patients in certain categories and assuming that everybody's going to act in the same way. Again, probably not intentional. I think part of the kind of the awakening of the medical profession around with information like this is quite genuine, and people in that people didn't feel that this was going on, and you don't recognize that it's not. You know, year 2002 is different than the 1940s, but
mm-hmm.
But it can still come out as we see in many ways, and certainly even where, as the caller Ellie was just describing, even where we know there are differences in kind of cultural in norms and behavior and expectations, it's still translating into patients feeling like they're not getting good care. In our survey, Hispanics and Asian Americans, in fact, consistently rated their care much more negatively even than African Americans. So while some of the cultural norms might be to not ask questions of the doctor and not being as involved, it was also translating into very negative ratings of their doctor.
And it ends up in real issues of care. We're talking about a race gap in American healthcare. Have you felt yourself shortchanged at the doctor's office on the basis of race? Is American medicine even aware of race prejudice in medical care? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a race gap in American healthcare. Doctors, nurses, give it to us straight. Have you seen, are you aware of race bias in health treatment? Have you, as a medical professional, felt yourself withholding care from a patient of color? Are American doctors impatient with, less sympathetic toward, patients who don't look like them, eat like them, speak like them? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Dr. Joseph Bettencourt. He is Director for Multicultural Education at Massachusetts General Hospital, and by Dr. Karen Scott Collins, Vice President of the Commonwealth Fund. Betsy is on the line. Welcome, Betsy. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I had a question for the guests tonight.
Okay.
I'm a physician myself.
Great.
And, someone previously said that they felt that perhaps physicians were more impatient or didn't review the files of African Americans. To tell you truthfully, when I walk in the room, I don't know what the race of my patient is going to be if I don't know them until I open the door.
So you are certainly race blind until the door swings open.
Yes, absolutely. It's not like I check the chart and say, oh, this is an African-American person. I'm not going to review their chart. I have no clue.
And what about when you're in the room, Betsy? In your case or in the case of your colleagues, can you imagine race coming into the equation?
In certain diseases, yes. I mean, I'm not going to ask a person of Northern European extraction about sickle cell disease in their family when I'm doing a family history. So clearly, that has to be, that is different.
But that's something scientific. We're really asking, I guess, here a cultural question, a social question. Can you imagine race influencing the care you or other doctors give for the worse? That's what these statistics seem to suggest.
I can certainly imagine that there are physicians out there that would. I can't imagine myself doing it because I don't, my training is that you do the very best you can for everyone. But I can certainly believe, that these data show that people are not getting the best care. What I wondered in particular is whether it's possible to tease out from the information we have whether, in fact, minority physicians provide care to minority patients differently than Caucasian physicians do. Because I have the feeling sometimes the reasons minority patients do not get the care they should get are more cultural than things that are happening in the examination room. The patient who has a limited income, who does not qualify for Medicaid, who cannot afford the medications that would provide optimum treatment of their chronic illness, does not get optimal care, but that may not be because the physician is not trying to prescribe the correct medications, but because this patient cannot afford them.
So there's two issues there, but Betsy, our time's running down, but I thank you for your call. I want to put this to Joe Bettencourt. What about, Betsy asks, let's say an African-American patient has an African-American doctor. Are they more likely in that case to get better care? Can you tell from your study?
There is some work that's been done that has looked at communication processes between African American doctors and African American patients, and in fact showed that African American patients felt like their visits were more participatory. And what I mean by that is they were able to have a better exchange and have their opinions heard in a better fashion when their physician was African American versus white. Clearly, we don't have a full body of evidence that would support this in any broader sense, and I think that's one area we want to research in the future.
And with only less than 4% of American doctors being black, that's not going to be a solution in any case. Manny's calling from Midville, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Manny. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for allowing me to talk to you.
Good to have you.
There were definitely social, racial, and ethnic and religious differences in our approach to treating patients.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be different, actually, for everybody.
You're saying they should be?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Mm-hmm. I think we need to approach people differently based on their needs, their ethnic background, etc.
So do we have to take all doctors and send them for another degree in sociology in addition to their medical degree, Manny?
Well, I think that people who are more exposed to different cultures in the world, I am originally from South America, and I've been in the United States for almost 20 years, practicing cardiologist. I think that it boils down to being a compassionate, good listener, and more importantly, understanding of the patient's emotional and physical needs.
Manny, we're losing your telephone, and I'm sorry for that, but I want to take your point and put it to Karen Scott Collins. Manny's a cardiologist. He's from South America, practiced in the United States for a long time, and he's saying medical professionals simply have to be very empathetic listeners.
I think it's an excellent point. And many of the curriculum for medical students and residents now are trying to come up with something that's manageable for people. So not trying to teach everyone about every single conceivable culture and social circumstance that they might come across at some point, but a basic set of questions. How do you approach a patient? How do you elicit any differences or concerns or ways of thinking about a condition or taking medication that might be different than what you usually see in your mm-hmm. practice? I think that that's a very promising model and approach to make sure we incorporate into medical school training and residency.
Mm. Jack Beatty, this is always the joy and burden of being an American. We've got this great rainbow, but then we still have to learn how to talk to each other, even in the process of delivering medicine.
Yeah, you know, it's almost as if the doctor has got to say to himself when he's seeing the black patient, wait a minute, I'm in American history here. There was slavery in this country. There was 100 years of segregation. There was the Tuskegee experiment. What I say is fraught with that transference, mm-hmm. and I've got to allow for that. I've got to deal with that. That's just not – that's a clinical fact. And I think doctors have to take that kind of thing into account, which would make them communicate better, not necessarily differently, but understand that they have to talk things through, perhaps in a way they wouldn't have to do with a, you know, if they were standing in front of a white patient, just because history has given us what it has.
It is inescapable. Joseph Betancourt, you've put this study in our face. What solutions are you offering?
Sure. I just want to say that was an excellent point. And in terms of solutions, the IOM has come up with a variety of recommendations. To boil them down real quickly, number one, we think there needs to be better awareness, higher awareness, both on the side of the public and the side of healthcare providers. Number two, we think we need to address systems. We need to improve incentives that allow physicians and patients to develop better relationships. We think that physicians and patients actually want the same thing. And so incentives that could do that, exploring ways to do that would be very effective. We need to collect data based on race and ethnicity to track our progress. I think we need to support interpretation services in cases where language barriers pose a challenge to delivery of quality of care. I think diversity is another issue that we put out there. I don't think we were recommending that there needs to be racial matches between providers and patients. We just think, as Manny said, that there is benefits in diversity as it relates to the discourse that could happen between diverse group of physicians learning about different cultures. We also think that physicians can do more. I think Jack Beatty's point is excellent, to understand some of these mm-hmm. dynamics, to understand the way they may make decisions and how they may be unintentionally susceptible to stereotyping, and some key tools and skills, in essence, revisiting the art of medicine and asking questions.
Mm. Joseph Betancourt, we want to thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Joe Betancourt is a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee that prepared this report. He is Director for Multicultural Education at Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Karen Scott Collins, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Jeff.
Karen Scott Collins is Vice President of the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation that supports independent research on health and social issues. You can read several studies on the racial disparities in American healthcare at our website. The address is onpointradio.org. Coming up, an appreciation of Mr. Television, Milton Berle. This is On Point. Comedian Milton Berle died at age 93. In the early days of television, Milton Berle was TV's supreme commander. Coming out of vaudeville, radio, and film, he almost single-handedly led the television revolution. Bob Thompson, director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University, reflected on the life and career of Mr. Television, Milton Berle.
He was very, very popular for a very short period of time on television, in the late 1940s and the 1950s. And as an American comic, he was not the best that we'd ever seen. There were many people who would come after him that were so much better. Don Knotts as a character comic. Lucille Ball is a slapstick physical comedian. But the thing that Milton Berle did, he was the guy that got out there and did a show that forced people who didn't want to spend a lot of money on a TV set when there was nothing on to go down to their store, buy a TV with a lot of money, drag it home, move the radio out of that sacred place in the living room, and shove the TV where the radio used to be.
Now listen, Francis, look, this is the year of goodwill toward men. Goodwill toward men, and in your point, I'm going to stretch your point, and I'm going to include you. Don't you mean? So let's not have any fights anymore. Let's make up.
Huh? I say?
Let's make up.
I'm glad you said that. Make up!
You know, there was a lot of other comedians working back then in radio and doing very well. Jack Benny, Bob Hope, George Burns, and Gracie Allen. And they wanted nothing to do with this second-class citizen television, this upstart that was being subsidized by radio. Milton Berle, who in fact hadn't done that well in radio, got out there and made a show that everybody had to watch. That's why they called him Mr. Television. And even though other people would later come to television, he was the one that cleared the real estate. He was the Christopher Columbus, the pilgrims of television. It was as though this guy was getting up on the top of the mountain and screaming at the top of his lungs, "The medium has arrived. Television is here. Jump on this bandwagon with me and all America will change." And that's exactly what he did.
Old-timer, you don't mean to think that I'm an old-timer, do you?
Well, after all, Milton, you have been in show business for 40 years.
Yes, but I was 5 years old when I started. And figure it out, 5 from 40, I'm 35 years old. That's all I am.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you were older than that.
Oh, what do you mean? How could I be? My mother's only 37.
Milton Berle was a raunchy guy. I think a lot of people would be shocked if they, in fact, sat down and picked up some of these home videos that are out there and watched this show. Television, when it got into the later part of the 1950s, really cleaned up its act as it became a mass medium that was playing all across the country. When Berle started in the late 40s, TV was still primarily an urban Eastern phenomenon, and he did a lot of pretty raunchy stuff. Even as TV kind of cleaned up its act and other people moved in to take Berle's place, Berle always kind of kept that raunchy behavior. If you look at some of the work he did with the roasters organizations, this is a guy that told a lot of jokes that we could not tell on this radio show.
In the past 40 years, I have sautéed Swedish meatballs. I have fricasseed French frog's legs. I have fried Portuguese suckling pig, and I have broiled Hawaiian mahi-mahi. But this is the first time in my culinary career that I have ever roasted an Austrian asshole.
Milton Berle's influence is all over the place, but it's in some fairly subtle kinds of ways. On one level, of course, he kind of established the style of the television variety show. And while that spread like wildfire across TV in the 1950s, we don't see it much on network television, but we do see it still in the late-night comedy programs, some of the stuff that plays on MTV and so forth. This whole idea of getting out, telling a few jokes, introducing a musician, doing some comedy sketches, and all the rest of it. The way in which his influence is most felt, however, is in the anti-Berle style that has been taken up by stand-up comics and late-night comedians. When David Letterman, for example, does one of his rim shots after a joke, which he's doing ironically, what he's in fact doing is homaging what Milton Berle was doing very seriously. That having been said, though, even though the Berle style is very old-fashioned, even though it's something that's now joked upon by people like Letterman, when you go back and watch the opening of one of those shows, that was a theme song, it was a commercial, in many ways it was a national anthem. It was the music that played while this extraordinary dance of television began. And one really has to take one's hat off to Milton Berle for in fact beginning this extraordinary period of television history for everybody else to pick up and run with.
Bob Thompson is director for the Center of the Study of Popular Television. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakraparty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Tim Skog, and Laura Tenguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.